Good evening. Welcome to Congressman Mike Capuano's telephone community meeting. My name is Allison, and I thank you for joining us tonight. If you have a question at any point during this evening's call for Congressman Mike Capuano, please press star 3 to begin that process. We will post an audio file of tonight's discussion, if you're not able to stay with us for the entire time, on our website once it's available. To access that file or to sign up for Congressman Capuano's electronic newsletter, please visit our website at capuano.house.gov. If you do have a question for Congressman Capuano tonight, please press star 3 at any point. And with that, I'd like to turn the meeting over to Congressman Capuano, who would like to make a few opening comments. Congressman?
Thanks, Allison. I just want to welcome everybody who's joined us for this call this evening. I apologize for interfering with your night, but at least there's no football. But I did want to have an opportunity to chat with everybody just before the holidays really get settled in here. And I just want to do some brief introduction. Congress obviously is in session. We expect to be in session all week, maybe next week, depending on what we get done and what we don't get done this week. I think just as way of background, the last few weeks we have accomplished a few things under the new speaker, but nothing so dramatic. I mean, we did do a visa waiver bill today to tighten that up just a little bit. It's not as much of a big deal as some would have you think, but it's better than doing nothing. And we did do a highways bill last week, which is a good bill. It pretty much maintains the status quo, lets us increase spending just a little bit to maintain our highways and transit systems and bikeways and other things. But it doesn't really catch us up from the backlog that we have accumulated over the last many years. But again, something is better than nothing, especially in today's world. We do have several bills that are still pending, the most important of which is the appropriations bill to keep government funded and to determine if we're going to move this country forward to see if we can invest in ourselves as we move forward. We have some issues on the tax extenders. We have tax items that are running out at the end of this year, and we have to decide whether we're going to extend them. And if we do, how do we pay for them? Because every time you give one person a tax break, obviously you either have to cut spending or you have to increase the deficit. And my hope is that we either cut spending or raise revenues or whatever we do so that people know that there is no free lunch in this world and no free lunch for government either. I know that Democrats are trying hard to do something on gun control. I think the chances of us succeeding at this point in time are still very small. Though it's a surprise to most of my friends and my constituents, the majority of members of Congress still don't think that we need to do anything at all on gun control, including getting guns out of the hands of people who are on the terrorist watch list. And obviously, we still have the whole problem in the Middle East over our heads. Is exactly trying to figure out what to do. I, for one, think that the president should come to Congress, and he has said he would come and seek authorization to take military action. I don't know how I'd vote on that yet. It would depend on what his goals were and what he thought we could actually accomplish and who was with us. Right now, I've thought for a long time that our actions over there are probably beyond the limits of the Constitution. I think when you bomb another country, that you should have Congress's approval to do that. All that being said, we still have a lot on our plate. We still have a lot to do, and time will only tell over the next few weeks as whether we can get this done, whether the new leadership in the House really is something new or if it's just the same old, same old. So with that, I think I'm going to stop and see if we can go to questions. If anybody does have a question, please press star 3, and we will try to get to you tonight. We're going to be on the phone for a little while, and for those of you who can stick around, I appreciate it. For those of you who can't, I appreciate you at least taking a few minutes to listen. With that, I think I'm going to stop and see what questions we might have.
And we do have some callers waiting to ask questions. If you would like to ask the congressman a question, please press star 3. And we will start tonight in Boston with Emily, who has a question related to education. Emily, whenever you're ready.
Yes. Hi, Congressman. Thank you. I feel that you've addressed a lot of the concerns that I do have after the recent events with the changes in the House, and I want to thank you for addressing those. On a personal level, I'm a teacher and a parent, and I'm concerned about the role high-stakes testing is playing in our schools, and I want to know what you think we can do to reduce that nationally to students.
For a long time, since when I was mayor of Somerville, I have never thought that the testing that we do has been appropriate. I think there's always testing in life. There's nothing wrong with appropriate use of testing, but I think that education today has gone way too far towards the goal of teaching to a test. they're a high-stakes test in the world. We call them the SAT. They've always been there. They or some other test will always be there to determine who makes it into the schools of their choice when it comes to higher education. And when I certainly think that testing is appropriate, trying to figure out people meeting minimum standards, but I don't think that we're helping our children by teaching them to regurgitate information. I think that we're falling down and teaching our children how to think, especially think independently, and that's proven out by most of the colleges. I'm fortunate enough to represent 34 colleges and universities, ranging from some of the greatest institutions in the world to community colleges and some junior colleges. And I'll tell you, pretty much every one of those schools tells me that on a regular basis they have to accept students that need some remedial work before they can start college-level work. And I don't think that's a great comment on our system. And I do think it's because teaching facts to students, certainly some facts are important, 2 + 2 = 4. But facts are only facts. You have to be able to put them together. You have to be able to make a sentence. You have to be able to understand how facts interact with each other. And I think that the excessive amount of testing that we do, I think, has really reduced the ability of teachers to really open children's minds and to teach them how to think the way most people do on a daily basis, especially the successful people in the world. So I've always been concerned with them. I'm not sure that we'll be able to get off them. It seems it's a nice, easy way for people to hang their hat on something and say, look, I'm for tough testing. I'm for tough education reform. I just think that the results are questionable, and I think that we're going to have a problem with our society unless we regain the interest and ability to really investing the time and energy to teaching children how to think. And my hope is we'll be able to do it. Hope the sooner the better, as far as I'm concerned.
If you'd like to ask the congressman a question this evening, just press *3 to begin that process. And we have a question from Ellie in Cambridge, related to gun control. Ellie, whenever you're ready, your question for the congressman.
Hello, my name is Ellie Yarden. We've talked before. And an observation which I made because of something which I circulated at a meeting Sunday of the schools called by the Cambridge schools. The information which I get on gun deaths comes from England, and I can get more accurate information by reading The Guardian than I can by any U.S. source. And I was wondering what you think can be done about it.
For gun control in general? Unfortunately,
no,
I wouldn't.
No, getting the data, getting information. The United States doesn't allow data to be collected by medical epidemiologists.
You mean relative to gun problems? That I just want to make sure I
understand. Gun deaths, yeah, the gun deaths. There's an epidemic of gun deaths in this country like no place is seen.
Ellie, I think you've kind of put your finger on one of the problems. That's why, I hate saying this to people because no one wants to hear it, at least, especially in my district. The likelihood of us being able to pass substantial legislation dealing with any aspect of gun control, including even the research related to it, is very minimal because the people who oppose it think that any information is going to go against them because, of course, I agree with you that it would go against them, that would indicate that reasonable, thoughtful gun control can reduce the instance of gun violence and the instance of especially gun deaths. And that being the case, they have prohibited the government from collecting this data. I'm actually very interested and very happy that you know that fact because most people don't know that level of detail. But that to me is symptomatic of the problems we have. We can't even collect data. What makes anybody think that Congress is ready to actually implement reasonable, thoughtful gun control legislation? Right now, like it or not, those people that are on the side of the NRA, and I mean the NRA officially, not necessarily individual members of the NRA, like it or not, they have the sway over Congress because they are vigilant politically every single day of the year. They hold people accountable. They will vote on a single issue. And they are vocal and adamant about their position, and people listen to them. People who agree with me that thoughtful gun control is possible and that we should be able to at least collect data on it. Though we are vocal on occasion, we tend to, get involved with other issues as soon as the spotlight is off it. So at the moment, Ellie, I regret to tell you that though we'll try, and actually members of the Democratic Caucus today did everything we could to try to bring up a gun control bill. I don't see the realistic expectation that things are going to change in the short term.
Now I have a question from Jim from Somerville, who would like to talk about the highway bill that just passed. Jim, whenever you're ready.
Hey, Congressman. Thanks for calling. This is like the first political call I've gotten in a while that I thought, wow, wouldn't it be great if the guy just actually called? So I got to ask you. You said that the highway bill that you passed was a good bill, and it was good because it maintained the status quo. And my question is, the bridges are falling down, the roads are falling apart. How can you say that the status quo was good? And what would you say would be a better way to approach the problem of funding the highways?
Well, Jim, you got me on this one, because I have to admit that in the current situation in Washington, my expectations have been lowered. Status quo is about as good as I get on pretty much anything now. There's been virtually no advancements on the issues I'm concerned with for several years now. And this is one of them. Honestly, we had not had a highway bill in, 10 years, something like that, a long-term highway bill. This is a five-year bill. So therefore, the cities and towns and states across the country have never been able to really have any long-term planning. They're always kind of just doing what they can do with patching things together. This at least allows them to have some longer-term planning. They know how much money they're going to get over the next 5 years. And that's why I say it's a good bill. And it is. It has a lot to do with my lowered expectations of status quo being good in these days. What do I think would be a good bill would be something that actually understood that we have to increase funding for highways. But honestly, though I'm a progressive on most every issue, when it comes to spending, I'm an old-fashioned fiscal conservative. And what that means is that I don't think that people should be told they can get something for free. If we're going to increase spending in one area, which I would strongly argue we should, for the very reasons you said, our highways are falling down, our transit system is in trouble, our water systems are in trouble, on and on and on. And it's across the country. It's not just Massachusetts. But that means increased spending, which means we have to do one of two things, either cut spending someplace else, which I could certainly, if you made me emperor, I could certainly come up with ways to do that, or to raise revenue. The problem with cutting spending is if you cut defense spending, for the sake of discussion, we need 218 votes in the House. We don't have it. Most people would argue that we should spend more on defense. And if you follow the arguments here in Washington, you'll hear that argument all the time. And no one here wants to raise taxes. I don't mind raising taxes if I look you in the eye and say, you're going to pay a little bit more gas tax. You're paying the same gas tax you paid 20 years ago. You can't tell me that about anything. You pay more for milk, more for eggs, more for your mortgage, more for your shirts. And you probably get paid more. Hopefully you get paid at least a little bit more than you did 20 years ago. Yet we're getting the exact same gas tax we got 20 years ago. And that's crazy. All that being said, again, the realistic part of it is no one's going to raise taxes down here. There aren't enough of us. And no one is going to be able to say, yes, the thing I'm interested in, defense or whatever else it might be, they should take a haircut so we can put more money into transportation. So for me right now, we're stuck in a little bit of a vortex until this country realizes that an investment in infrastructure is good for all of us. The last person, by the way, to double the gas tax, was President Ronald Reagan, the king of modern conservatism. Because he understood that that was a direct investment in all of us. We have better roads, better transit. That's good for everybody. That's an investment in ourselves for our own future. And I don't hear any right-wing people telling me that he was some kind of a bad Republican. But yet he could do it, yet we can't find the wherewithal to do anything with it. So with that being said, again, the realistic expectation I have is that not much is going to change. So therefore, yeah. This is a decent bill because I have to live in the real world. I also want to apologize to everybody. I just came over a cold, so on occasion I might cough a little bit, and I apologize for that.
If you're just joining us and you have a question for Congressman Capuano, please press *3. We now have Mrs. Bennett from Hyde Park on the line who would like to ask about unemployment. Mrs. Bennett, whenever you're ready.
Thank you very much. Good evening, Congressman Capuano. First of all, I would like to thank you because the few times I have reached your office, they have always been very receptive to me. I used to be a legislative aide myself. My question has to do with unemployment and competing as Americans globally. I'm actually a presentation designer. I tend to go on a lot to the social media, such as LinkedIn, to compete for contracts or through creative agencies. And I find that every single day it gets harder and harder for us as Americans to compete because we're being outbid by other countries such as India. And for the jobs that I would normally charge between $20 to $50 per hour, I'm being outbid by somebody in another part of the world from $5 to $10 per hour, which is impossible to please a client. I believe that education is important. I always listen to the president myself. I'm an Ivy League graduate, and there's just not much more I can do to be any more to what I'm doing. So I was wondering, what can we do as Americans to better ourselves since we're not getting the contracts?
Well, first of all, thanks, Ms. Ben. I appreciate the call and the question. Here's part of the problem. In an economy that is globalizing every day, we are in competition with the rest of the world for certain things, not for everything, but for certain things. And what that does, yes, that usually does drive wages down. And that's been my problem with almost every trade bill we have voted on. Almost every trade agreement we have has us in competitions with countries that do not live to our standards. And are able to do exactly what you just pointed out. And on some things, that's acceptable to a certain extent. I understand that. But it's happened way too much. There has been no thought put into it, in my opinion, by any administration, including this administration, but no prior administration has really put any deep thought into how we can balance an international economy with our own personal needs. If it is nothing more than a drive to the lowest wage index, that's not going to be good for anybody. It's certainly not going to be good for us. Maybe it'll be good for the low-wage countries, but it will be terrible for us. It'll kill the middle class, and it will kill, in my opinion, the beauty of America, which is why I had so much trouble voted for, I believe, two trade deals since I've been here. And even then, I was questionable on both of them. And I will tell you that I think that's – we have another one coming up with what's called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And right now, I would probably vote no, but I'm not sure that my side would win because the desire for cheap goods. I don't know anybody who says, oh, I'm not buying that shirt because it was made in a low-wage country. I also don't know anybody who pays less for a shirt than they used to pay when those shirts were manufactured in Taunton. When wages go down, prices have not gone down either. So for me, I think America has to look a little bit more after our own interests, not to hurt the rest of the world, not to be an isolationist, not to say we don't want to trade with anybody, we don't want to be part of the global economy, but to simply say we have to find a better way to balance it. I don't think we're doing ourselves any favor, and I think that the situation you express is a classic example of the problems we have that we have short-sightedly not had an honest discussion about.
If you're just joining us and you have a question for the congressman, please press *3. We now have Glenn, who would like to ask the congressman about Social Security. Glenn, whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Good evening, Congressman, and thank you for the good job you're doing. My question is, why are we not getting a cost of living increase on our Social Security? I receive SSDI, my full disability. And usually we get $20 a year, and Congressman, that $20 matters. And is this a continuous thing, and what are the Democrats doing to fight for our cost of living every year?
It's an excellent question, Glenn. The Social Security cost of living is based on a formula, and that formula is based on an economist definition of what the cost of living is. And this year there's no cost of living increase, mostly because the cost of oil has gone down. That's been the main factor in the basket that they put together to try to consider how much cost of living has gone up. Well, our argument is that most people that are on Social Security don't really have to worry about that too much. There is a different formula. It's a different basket of goods that is considered, and this one is basically tended mostly towards the elderly because that's how most people are on Social Security. And it takes into account the things that they actually spend their money on a more regular basis. For instance, a lot heavier emphasis on medications, and a little bit less emphasis on things like driving around. Most of our senior citizens don't drive as much as they might need medicine. And under that formula, it would have gone up, oh, I don't remember, I think it was like a 1.5%. It's not a lot because we do have low inflation, but at least it was something. It was a recognition of the reality that that most people on Social Security face. Democrats have been pushing to do that. Thus far, we haven't had much success, but we're going to keep pushing because, again, we're just trying to be a little bit fairer to people and try to not give money away. That's not what we're trying to do, but we are trying to say what are the real costs of living on a fixed income, and how can we be honest about it as opposed to simply just looking at the bottom line. I don't know. We might have some success with that, but we haven't had yet, so we're going to keep trying, though.
We now have Gina, who has a question about Planned Parenthood. Gina, whenever you're ready, your question for the congressman.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Gina.
Good. My name is Gina. My question about Planned Parenthood is they're trying to dismantle it or not have it, you know, people use it. But Planned Parenthood does more than just provide abortions. And my concern is why every time a vote comes up, they attach Planned Parenthood to it. And the other, my other issue is they have no problem making sure that men have Viagra and Cialis and all those drugs, but every time women need services, first thing they go after is Planned Parenthood. And my question is, at what point is this going to stop?
No,
really. I mean,
no, I'm laughing, Gina,
women,
because you just said it better than I can say it.
I mean, women have to practically beg and, like, you know, this has been going on for years, but yet when men need the drugs they need to, you know, for their dysfunction, there's no issues.
Well, I agree with you on every point, Gina. A few years ago, they did vote to not cover Viagra. Now, I personally think it should be covered, but that's a different issue. So it's not covered by Medicare. But I couldn't agree with you more on the Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood is a health care agency. We give out a lot of money to 1,000 different health care agencies. Planned Parenthood just seems to be the pinata that they like to kick every once in a while. And they wrap themselves around the pro-choice issue as if that's all Planned Parenthood does. And you said it better than I can do. That's not mostly what they do. Mostly what they do is provide health care services just like any other local community health center type of thing. When will they stop? They will stop when people make them stop. Right now, it seems to play to some of their bases to say, oh, yeah, we have to hate somebody. Who do we hate? We hate that Planned Parenthood. I don't think they're going to succeed. I'm pretty sure that they will not succeed, but that doesn't mean that they won't keep hitting that pinata.
If you're just joining us and you have a question, please press *3. Marie from Somerville is joining us with a question about Syrian refugees. Whenever you're ready, your question.
Hi, Mr. Capuano. Excuse me, please. I know that you voted to not boycott Muslims coming into the country, Syrians. Now, my sources really are the New York Times and the Globe, and I read about the vote of two of the Massachusetts representatives in Washington. I think his first name is Steve, Mr. Lynch from South Boston. And this is the one I want to quote, but I don't remember his last name. Representative William something from Bourne. And he said, it was right in the Globe. I have it right in my house. Cut it out. We have no intelligence in Syria. So how can we vent anybody, woman, child, anybody? I don't get it. How come we have no intelligence in Syria, Representative Capuano?
First of all, I didn't vote that way. I don't agree with that assessment. I mean, you know, people can disagree on issues. I think we do have, number one, some intelligence. Number two is we don't let people in unless we have intelligence on those individuals. It has nothing to do with what intelligence we have in a certain country. We vet the individuals, not the country. And we look the individuals in the eye. We ask them questions. We check out databases to see who's on it. And by the way, many of the Syrian refugees are not Muslim. Many of them are Christians. There's a big Christian community there. And so, therefore, for me, I think that the system's working fine. Just last year, we let well, last year the big boogie person in the whole world was Iran. We all hated Iran. Oh, it's dangerous. They're building a nuclear weapon. They want to come and get us. And yet, at the same time, we let thousands of Iranian refugees in. Now, the Iranian government wasn't working with us or cooperating with us, and no one said a word. I mean, the people that are all worried about, you know, people hiding under their bed, nobody said a word. Every year we let refugees from around the world in. We've let 700,000 in since 9/11. And they don't come from places like England or France or Italy or Ireland or Germany. They come from places like Syria and Iran and other places that are hotbeds and volatile, because these are the places where people are being persecuted. They are being persecuted because of their religion. They are being persecuted because of what tribe they live they're in, or what sect of what religion they're in, or whatever else it might be, their race or their gender. I mean, it's all kind of depends on where it is, what's going on. And we judge people individually. That is what we've always done. It takes a minimum of 18 months to 2 years to get people into this country. And by the way, to my knowledge, none of these things have been committed by refugees in America or any place else in the world. So I'm comfortable that no system is perfect, but our system to vet refugees is reasonably good. Plus, I also think it calls us to our higher values as Americans to say when somebody is coming from a war-torn country that we can take them in. I'm not gonna, we can't take them all, but we can do our fair share in the world, and that's why I voted the way I did.
Now have John with a question about the Green Line extension. John, whenever you're ready.
Hi, Mr. Capuano. How are you doing?
Hey, John. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. I have a question for you, Mr. Capuano.
Yep.
What do you or the Secretary of Transportation intend to do about the $1 million shortfall that's being...
Well, that's it's a billion-dollar potential shortfall. That one's on the state. The Green Line extension is a partnership between the state and the federal government. And when there's a process for these things, and when the state applied to the federal government for the federal government's share of the partnership, the state said it's going to be approximately $2 billion to build the Green Line extension. And based on that, the federal government said, okay, we will do half, and you do half. So the federal government says we'll give $1 billion, the state will give $1 billion. And by the way, don't come back to us and ask us for more, because, you know, that's what you asked us for, that's what we'll give you, and that's where we're at. Right now, the overruns, any overruns, and the Green Line extension is no different than the Big Dig was, no different than any project in the state or the country. Once the federal government makes the deal, that's it. Overruns are on the back of the state, and that's exactly what the state is doing right now. They're reviewing this and researching it, and I think within the next few weeks you're going to have some proposals and plans from the state as to what they will do with it. And when that happens, we will listen and we'll have a much more deep discussion about it.
Now I have Tara, who would like to ask about airplane noise. Tara, whenever you're ready, your question.
Hello. I'm calling just to follow up on last week's meeting. I have a couple of questions, actually, but particularly last week's meeting, I attended the forum with the FAA that happened down in Milton.
Yep.
And I thought it was so important that I drug my kids there. My husband was out of town. I brought my kids there, so I couldn't stay the whole time. So I don't know how the meeting concluded, but I wanted to know what were your takeaways from Thursday night's meeting? You know, if the FAA has any plans to reevaluate the RNAV program that's affecting West Somerville, where I live?
I live on Winter Hills, so whatever you get, I get. I can only tell you, Kara, that I've been working with the FAA now on this for, 2 years. I know they've been doing studies. They're conducting reviews right now. Two of the three they're supposed to do have been done. We will continue working with them to try to – they had to get the system in place. They had to get the system working. I will tell you that the FAA doesn't do anything quickly, and I kind of understand that. They did not implement the system quickly, and they will not change it quickly. But I do think that their ears are open. Honestly, I thought their ears were open to begin with. I mean, their public persona has never been the greatest at all. They're kind of very bad at that. I've always thought that they would be willing to work with us within the parameters that they have. Namely, they're going to use the system because it is efficient. My argument, it has always been, use the system, but not every plane has to go over the same house all day long. Logan Airport is a regional benefit, and it's not going away. We're not moving it. Those days are over. We're stuck with it, good, bad, or indifferent. But we all travel. We all use goods that come through Logan Airport. We all know that. So it's a regional benefit. Any regional benefit also has detriment. Obviously, in this case, it's noise and pollution. And my argument has always been that noise and pollution, the detriment should be equally shared to as much as reasonable. And that's what we're working with the FAA trying to do, is to try to get them to move these routes a little bit as best they can to spread them out so everybody gets just a little bit of the pain and nobody gets all of the pain on behalf of the whole community. So I think that over time we'll be able to make some improvements. But I will tell you, the FAA is notoriously slow, and I don't expect that to change. So it's going to take us a little while.
John is joining us now with a question about student loans. John, whenever you're ready, your question for the congressman.
Good evening, Congressman.
Hey, John.
Hey, all your colleagues seem to always talk about helping out our kids with their student loans and everything. I got two boys. One of them buried. One is over $1,400 a month. The other one is just over $1,000 a month. Is anything being done at all? You do hear people talk about it, but there doesn't seem to be any action on this. Is there any hope for these kids to get out of these loans with some help?
Getting tougher and tougher. And I mean, one of my sons still has college loans as well. I can only tell you, John, that everything we have done thus far has been around the edges. We have tightened it up a little bit so you can at least have a better understanding of the bills, which used to be impossible to follow. There are some better deals for kids who are in college. We haven't done much for the kids who are already out. And part of the problem is that some of these notes, they're in private companies. When I was in college, student loans were a government program. The government does not have to make a profit. And that being the case, it was society saying, as a taxpayer, I am willing to put a few dollars on the table to loan them to Johnny and Mary so that they can go to college and they will pay me back, and not just pay me back, but also pay so the next generation can go with very small interest. I will tell you that when I graduated college, the interest rates I was paying was 3%. Now, in today's world, that's a lot, but in those days, that's when they were paying you 5% just to have your money in a checking account. So it was a pretty good deal. In today's world, it is not a good deal because we have private companies doing it. Now, that's not a bad thing, but private companies have to make a profit, which means they have to charge you more than you can earn in a bank. They have no choice. Otherwise, they can't make a profit. All that being said, I don't think anything serious is going to be done until we recognize the fact that the next generation getting educated is a good thing for the entire society. I don't know you, I don't know your children, but I know that my life will be better off if your children and everybody else's children have an opportunity and an education, because they'll be smarter, they'll make society better, they'll come up with smarter programs than you and I can come up with, and that's a good thing for all of us, not just for your kids. So that being the case, I personally think it's a good investment by society to make sure the next generation is educated. Until we get to that, I'm afraid we're going to just be talking around the edges. Otherwise, how do you have a private company make a loan and say, by the way, out of the goodness of your heart, we don't want you to make a profit? I mean, that's unreasonable, and no one in their right mind would do that. So until we get that to that point, I'm afraid that we're just nipping around the edges. We have done a couple of things. We will do a couple of more things, but it won't be anything dramatic.
Leo is joining us now with a question about renewable energy. Leo, whenever you're ready.
Yes. Hello, Congressman. I congratulate you for using this forum. I really like the fact that you're opening access and bringing it to the people in a very nice technology way.
Thank you.
I moved from Wisconsin, and I moved to Boston. I'm very happy I live in Boston. I'm really concerned about the trends I see in the country that seem to be moving backward and rolling the bar to lower and lower standards. One in particular that I'm very pleased with that I've seen in other states, I'd love to see you propose to adopt it here, is voter ID that's linked to Massachusetts driver's license. I think everyone should be allowed to vote and made easy to vote, and I think linking it to driver's license as one of the ways will just make it across the board. Whoever you vote for, it's easy. Just go out and vote and participate. So I'd love to propose that you follow I think it was Oregon State Secretary of State who had proposed it and pushed it through, and she became governor or something. But my question to you is on renewable energy and subsidies. I understand that Massachusetts has some subsidies that's been driving the renewable energy industry. I think that's a beautiful program as well. And I like the idea that renewable energy is really breaking the industry down to smaller pieces. You can have lots of jobs and technicians maintaining systems, lots of systems on different houses that wean us off of imported oil, cuts down our ability and our need to deal with the Middle East and wars and so on. So I'd love to see Massachusetts continue its subsidies. But I understand that there's a bill in the House that's going through now looking to end it. And that really gives me some concern. I'd like to know if you support its ending of the subsidies or if you continue, if you would support the continuation of the subsidies.
No. I'm very proud of what Massachusetts has done and will continue to do. Just because somebody files a bill, I don't think it will pass. Anybody can file any bill they want, and it doesn't mean anything. I think Massachusetts is very proud of what we've done in renewable energy, and I think most of us are more than willing and more than happy to do more. I think we'd love to be energy self-sufficient if we could get there, therefore stopping any reliance, not just on Middle East oil, but on Texas oil. Why should we be paying we pay a lot of taxes to Texas as well. So I don't think that bill will pass. I think most people in Massachusetts want to continue it, and I think it will be continued.
James from Boston is joining us with a question about education. James, whenever you're ready.
Hi, Congressman. I'm a 64-year-old gentleman here who's been a Boston guy his whole life. Still live in Boston, love the city, and that'll probably never change. You know, I came up through the 50s and 60s and the whole thing. And I guess my question is, I had asked one of the school committee running for office at one point that was out soliciting. I asked him how many schools were in Boston. I thought he told me 55 or 56. But the thing that amazed me was I asked him how many were vocational. And he told me one in Roxbury. And I sit here and I hear people talk about education and scoring and whatever they do with it. And I grew up when there was Boston Tech, Boston Trade, Charlestown High, and they were teaching trades. Now I see other communities with vocational schools and culinary arts and trades. You know, not every kid is a college kid. But being a chef myself, and I've been in the field 50 years and belong to chefs' organizations that support scholarships for kids going to culinary arts and all the rest of it. But there are tons of people in this industry, you know, they can make a living, and a good living, in a trade. And I'm not saying it's a chef, it could be as a plumber, it could be as an electrician. Why is I understand the focus on education, and I think for the colleges, just ridiculous. But, you know, there seems to be no control on that. They want to control everybody else's living, but never with these colleges taking it for their money. But when is there going to be a shift in focus back to the vocational in high school? I just think so many kids that have a hard time in the educational or college part of it would do hugely well in something they could use their hands and make a living their whole life at.
James, you brought a smile to my face. My argument has always been that every child should be given the opportunity to be the best at whatever they want to be, and that includes vocational education. I think, you know, Boston doesn't do it that way. They do it other ways, too. They also ship a lot of kids outside the city to do voc-ed as well. I'm not aware that there are kids who want voc-ed that are not educated in Boston, but it is different. And a lot of communities have done that. But at the same time, I think that some of the people that consider themselves education reformers, which I think I am too, but, you know, the ones that are the loudest about it, I think they have finally come around to understanding that exactly what you said. Any child who wants to go to college should be able to go to college, and I think most people should be encouraged to do that. But for any child who doesn't want to, they should be allowed to go into voc-ed if that's what they want to do, and given a great opportunity to do it. You were in school those days, Jim, you're probably going to take my age. I was in the college courses, but I was also required to take voc school for a certain period of time in junior high. It was a way to expose us to a different way of life and the ability to do things with your hands no matter what you do. And I will tell you that I tell kids all the time, it's wonderful. I want every child to be whatever they want. If you want to be a brain surgeon, if you want to be a computer scientist, that's great. You should have every opportunity to do it. And that goes right back to the student loan thing we were talking about. But remember one thing. When you make all that money and your wonderful success, You're still going to need somebody to fix your plumbing. You're still going to need somebody to fix your car. And you better hope that they're well-educated people and they deserve to make a decent living. So I tell you, James, I think that's starting to show a little bit, but I'm glad that people like you are out there pushing for it because I think you're 100% right.
Kate is joining us now with a question about paid maternity leave. Kate, whenever you're ready.
Hi, Congressman, and thank you for this forum. I'm curious. The U.S. is one of the few, if not only, industrialized nations without paid maternity leave. Curious what your position is on this issue, if it is a government responsibility to try to move the needle on this, or if it's private organizations, companies, and what is the government's role to help bring the United States a little bit closer to the rest of the industrialized world?
I think it's a societal issue. I mean, it's not the good old days, and you know, I've been around long enough, they weren't so good, but they were old. When, you know, women have babies, men go off to work, and women just stay home. Those days are over. Now, maybe they'll come back someday. I don't know. I don't care, but they're certainly not around now. And I will tell you that I am proud that when I was the mayor of Somerville, well before there was any state or federal laws, we instituted paid maternity leave for all city employees. Now, we couldn't. We did it because it's a value to us to have children. And I think it's a way to value women's role in the workplace. Again, it can't be forever because that's not fair to everybody else who's there. But it's some reasonable period of time to go get settled, have the child, get the child settled, get the family settled. I personally think it's a great goal. I think it's a societal goal, and therefore it makes it a government responsibility to push it as best we can. We're not going to get from where we are to where we want to be overnight, but I've always been on this corner, and I always will be. I don't know that we're going to get there in the near future, but I will tell you, Kate, that I'm proud of the small little role we did to move the needle, and I will tell you that I'm going to keep pushing as long as I can. I don't know that we're going to succeed right now because right now, let's be honest, it doesn't seem to be the kind of thing we talk about in Washington very often, but I do think that little by little, as women maintain themselves in the workplace, which I think they will, I don't think that it's going to change. I think that people are going to demand it. And I also think the family has changed. Families now, usually when people have children, if they're married, the both spouses play some role in the development of that child. So the world has changed, I think, for the better, but that's beside the point. Whether you like it or not, it's changed. And I do think that family values, this type of family values, are legitimate family values, and are the kind of thing that people, little by little, are going to continue to push for. So I think we'll get there, but it's just going to take us a while.
Denise is joining us now with a question about gun control. Denise, whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Congressman. I really appreciate having this forum and opportunity to talk to you about this tonight. Can I just say quickly, there's been a lot of very hateful rhetoric out of Washington and the campaigns in particular, and any voice of sanity that you and your peers can give to push down that very hateful talk is very much appreciated. But just going back to, I know, a question that somebody had asked earlier about gun control, I think as a citizen, what can we do to help the cause? I know the Massachusetts representatives have been very strong. I know we have very good gun control laws compared to the rest of the country. I think we're 1 in 7 that bans assault rifles. What can we do as a citizenship to counter what the NRA is doing to have our position heard?
The most important thing I can tell you is to stay vigilant, because I really meant what I said earlier. Every time there's a tragedy, everybody in the country stands up and says, oh, we have to have some reasonable gun control. And it lasts about a week. And then most people go back to their daily lives and say, oh, yeah, by the way, what about that gun control thing? I will tell you that the NRA does not go to sleep. They stay awake all the time. And that's part of the problem, is that your side, you know, we're alert, but we're not there every day. Now, I'm not suggesting anybody become a one-issue voter, but I think it's critical. Now, again, in Massachusetts, I wish I could tell you, yeah, go get this congressman, go get this state rep, but you're right. Massachusetts is one of the leaders in gun control. However, there are still some more things we might be able to do. I was reading a case today where there was a case that it wasn't a Massachusetts case, I don't think, where a court upheld, or actually the Supreme Court didn't even take a case trying to talk about an assault weapon ban in a local community. those are the kinds of things that we can take a lead on to prove continuously that states like Massachusetts that have reasonable gun control also can reduce the level of violence, which we have done repeatedly. So I think the best I can tell you, I wish I could tell you to do more. It'd be a lot easier to say, you know, one of our senators is no good on this issue, but the Massachusetts delegation is very good on this issue. I'm sure that they're all on the same side of it. So therefore, the best we can do is stay vigilant and to set an example for the rest of the country to follow. And on the national level, to make sure that you don't vote for a presidential candidate that doesn't support the concept.
We have time for just a few more questions this evening, and if we do not get to your question, we do apologize for that, but you will have an opportunity at the end of this telephone community meeting to leave a voicemail for Congressman Capuano. Andrew is joining us now with a question about immigration. Andrew, when you're ready.
Yes, thank you, Congressman, and I love the idea of the way you're using technology to bring us together at a low cost, and I encourage you to do it some more. My question is tying back to an earlier question about global wages, and it's going to tie into immigration. I work in high tech, and I'm lucky enough to work in an industry where most people are fairly well paid. But one of the challenges is that, you know, there's a lot of jobs that are currently being sent overseas where, you know, the wages are different and much lower than we get here. I work in a decision-making capacity there, and one of the reasons that tech companies are tempted to send the jobs overseas isn't because that they think they can save money on wages, and I would argue you're really not saving money anyway, but it's because we can't find the workers that we need here in the U.S. Part of that is due to the fact that we're not educating people, and that's a whole different question. But part of that is that we have a very, 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 very tight restraint on bringing people in to the, you know, bring immigrants in that have the skills. And, you know, my thought is I would much rather compete with someone who's living, you know, beside me two houses down than someone who's living in Bangalore or somewhere where the wages are much different. So my question is, do you think that this issue and the relationship between why jobs are moving overseas and immigration is well understood by you and your colleagues? And, you know, is this when immigration is discussed, is this ever talked about? In my mind, at least for some jobs, immigration could actually help the wage problem that we face.
I agree with you very much, Andrew. I will tell you that the answer is yes, it's discussed, but then it gets bogged down in the typical anti-immigration discussion that you've heard so many times on talk TV. I will tell you that I agree with you on many, many levels. I want people to come to this country and then want to stay here, just like my ancestors did, and I'm sure your ancestors did. And that would include everybody that we need to provide our economy what it needs, which means the base of the job. So every year, I think the people in the immigration department should look at the statistics from the previous year and say, you know what, we need 100,000 farm workers, we need 10,000 high technology people, and we need 20,000 engineers, you know, whatever it might be. And then that's who we should let in. That number of people who with those qualifications, and then the following year, do it all over again. See what we need the following year. For instance, right now in Massachusetts, as I said earlier, I have 34 colleges and universities in the district. Every year we graduate several thousand people from some of these great institutions with PhDs, advanced degrees in high technology. And you know what we do? We bring them in from all over the world, we educate them, and then we kick them out. I think that's insane. Because what do? When they graduate from MIT, first of all, they're not taking any American's position at MIT. Any American that can get into MIT for a graduate degree can get in. They're not taking their jobs. They're not taking their seat in the college. I would argue every single child or young person who graduates with an advanced degree, I'm not talking about an undergraduate degree, an advanced degree at MIT, Harvard, Boston College, Tufts, Northeastern, and all the other schools that I'm proud to represent, they should be handed their diploma simultaneously handed a green card and told, within the next X number of years, if you become an American citizen, you're welcome to stay here and to build your life here. Why? For the very reasons you just said. They're going to then create the jobs here, because these are the people that do create jobs. They're going to advance our society, and they will not be going home to then compete against us based on the education that we just provided them. It is absolute insanity, and I will tell you that thus far, because it has to do with immigration, I haven't been able to find any Republican sponsors. And I don't understand it, because it's good for business, it's good for America, it's good for our educational system, and it doesn't take a single job away from a single qualified American. Yet, because it's immigration, it's one of those hot-button issues, and we haven't been able to get our hands around it. So I think you're 100% right, Andrew, and I will tell you that my hope is that when we ever get around to a real immigration bill, this will be part of it.
Sheila is joining us now with a question about housing. Sheila, when you're ready.
Hello, Congressman.
Hi.
Thank you for the meeting. I want to ask you a question about money for housing, low-income and middle-class housing. We have a lot of homeless people that are living in the woods these days. And wouldn't it be pertinent to think about these single people or people with problems to build, get some money from the government to establish high-rise housing, maybe one-room apartments or something for starter apartments, so people can have a roof over their heads to get a job, clean themselves up, and move on or whatever. Is there any chance that Massachusetts can get more money for housing, to build housing, decent housing, the same way Northeastern builds 14-story high dormitories across from a project, low income, and they talk about tearing down that place so the students can feel better or whatever. But this is what we need. This is a problem in Massachusetts. The rents are too high. And how are you going to pay your rent when you can't find a place to stay? You can't even vote if you don't have an address.
Well, I'll tell you, Sheila, the federal government provides a lot of money into housing, but over the last, 20 years or so, little by little, that number has been eroding. We are way below what we used to provide. And honestly, that's why the city of Boston and every other city I represent struggles with trying to maintain affordable housing for people to be able to stay in the city. And to house the homeless. I mean, it should be a national disgrace in the richest country in the history of mankind that we have people that go without housing, many of whom are veterans, many of whom are single mothers with young children. It's to me, that's a national disgrace. I'm not talking about housing them in the Taj Mahal. I'm simply saying that's offensive. To me, it is anyway. At the same time, like anything else, as I said earlier with the highway bill, I hate to tell you, my definition of success in the last few years has been maintaining the status quo. And especially when it comes to housing, at least on transportation, there are a handful of people that agree with me. When it comes to housing, that handful really shrinks down to even less than a handful of people who are willing to stand up and fight for this. And it's because there's just a lot of people on the other side who just think that the government should have no role in providing housing to anybody. And little by little, they have won elections, and they come and they try to implement their policies, and people like me try to fight them. And we've succeeded in stopping them from killing programs, at least all the programs, but they have killed some. I don't know if you ever heard of the Hope 6 program, but that's the one that did Mission Maine. That's the one that did the housing in East Boston. And what they've done is they've taken old housing that was run down and dilapidated and completely rebuilt it into modern standards that provide some dignity to the people living there and some improvement, significant improvement to the neighborhood around it. But that program is dead now because we couldn't keep it. All that being said, I don't think that right now there's any likelihood the federal government is going to add more money to the housing mix. Again, I hate to tell you, my definition of success is trying to make sure that they don't cut it further. So we're going to continue to struggle. I think the Commonwealth actually does a pretty good job in consideration of the limitations they have, especially as compared to other states. We do a pretty decent job. They know that they're struggling as well. But I think the point you make are well taken, and all I can tell you is the struggle will continue.
And that is all we have time for this evening. We do apologize if we were not able to get to your question. You will have an opportunity at the end of this telephone community meeting to leave Congressman Capuano a voicemail with your question. And we will also post an audio file of the meeting on our website once it's available. And you can access that at capuano.house.gov. And with that, Congressman Capuano would like to close the meeting.
First of all, thank you, Allison. I'd just like to thank everybody who stayed with us, especially those who stayed with us the whole time. I also want to apologize for my occasional coughing. As I said, I'm getting over a little bit of a cold and trying to suck down some water and some hard candies here while I'm talking, but I apologize for that. But I hope you found this as good as I did. I had a great time tonight. I love talking issues with people. I know that we're not all going to agree on every issue. I get that. But I think it's important to, on occasion, for us to be able to talk as often as we can, and to at least exchange ideas, and so that I can hear from you what's on your mind, and hopefully you can hear from me at least what I'm thinking on the issues of concern. So with that, I want to say again, thank you all very much, and good night.